I'm Christopher Lydon with Kevin Young, the prolific African-American poet, family roots in sharecropper Louisiana. He was born in the Midwest, schooled at Harvard, then Brown. His first book in prose is called The Gray Album on the Blackness of Blackness. So much for post-black and post-racial, post-anything. It's not a political tract or a personal program either, and there's not much Barack Obama in it. It is a critical autobiography in soul music and the writers who furnished the many mansions of his mind. Bessie Smith, poets Paul Laurence Dunbar and Lucille Clifton, Ralph Ellison, Jimi Hendrix, James Baldwin, and hundreds more. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Kevin Young calls his The Blackness of Blackness the story of what I read, heard, and saw at the crossroads of African-American and American culture, which, as we will see, may be much the same rocky road. There's the kernel of the book, African-American Experience and Culture as the American Experience. So how does it grow?
Water, light, that kind of thing. I guess when I was setting out to write the Gray Album, because the subtitle, which you mentioned, came later, The Blackness of Blackness, I really was struggling with the subtitle. But the title, in many ways, was kind of generative. I had been writing these pieces often about saints and heroes of mine, from Langston Hughes to Dunbar, and really trying to get at their language, but maybe even more so their music. And I also was writing then about music almost as a kind of accompaniment. And pretty soon I realized how integral both were to each other. So I was really trying to write about the whole thing in some way. And I kind of joke in the introduction that I was looking for a unified theory, I suppose in some sense of blackness, but really of Americanness. And as you hinted, I think those things, while not necessarily interchangeable, are certainly so interdependent that it's worth talking about. And this idea of the Gray Album, which takes its name from a mashup of the Beatles and Jay-Z performed by Danger Mouse, really was a way of centering that idea. And in some ways, I think of the book as a kind of mashup, I suppose, of literature and music, but also this idea I have of lying. And this idea of lying is one based in African-American culture where lies is another name for folk tales. I have an epigraph for the book, or I should say two. One's from Zora Neale Hurston and one's from Ralph Ellison. And the Zora Neale Hurston one I love especially because she's quoting someone in her book Mules of Men where he says, you know, I'm going to lie up a nation. And this idea of lying up a nation seemed really important to me because it got at what I call storying. This idea that behind lying that sees these lies as stories, as tall tales, but also connects to the jazz tradition of a solo by Louis Armstrong or Charlie Parker telling its own story. And this idea of storying then becomes a lens for me to look at this unified theory.
Your own growth in blackness, and I'd love you to just recount it. It's very individual. It's the thread of your own self-education over, 40 years? But it also feels to me canonical. You speak of recovering and reclaiming aspects of black culture abandoned even by black folks, whether it's the blues or home cooking or broader forms of not just survival, but triumph. That's your words. It puts you in the role, it seems to me, Kevin Young, of a sort of curator of the core experience. You're telling us all what has to be remembered.
Well, and I also think that's right, but I also think I'm thinking about what's sometimes lost. On the one hand, I really want to record and get a sense of what we inherit and what we decide to keep, which seems to me a good definition of the tradition, the two being slightly different. But also there was a way in which I was trying to think about what I end up calling the shadow book, the book that isn't there anymore, the things that are lost that we sometimes forget from the sound of Buddy Bolden's horn in New Orleans, and then also, you know, lost books that either weren't written or have been literally lost. And I talk a little bit about Lucille Clifton. Her mother was a poet, but sort of under the pressure from her disapproving father, Lucille Clifton's mother's husband, she burned her poems, you know, as this almost kind of I think of it almost as a self-immolation or a kind of denial or defiance, even in its destruction. And having those poems back, having that kind of legacy of poetry, I mean, that's part of the inheritance that Clifton herself was wrestling with. And, you know, she picked my first book to be published, and it was such a gift in the sense of being connected to her for all time. But then years later, I, as a literal curator, helped get her archived to Emory University, where I'm the curator of literary collections and of the Raymond Donosky Poetry Library. So in a way, these things come full circle, and I'm also now finishing editing her collected poems, which will be out in the fall of this year. And just thinking about, you know, that circle, which I see stretching back even to her mother, and but to her poems and then to my poems, and this kind of legacy of recovery, reclamation, lostness, but also that's the survival and triumph there too.
At the end of March 2012, as we speak, Kevin Young, I just have to mention the awful murder of Trayvon Martin in Florida. What could be taken as a sort of one-on-one modern-day lynching. And it feels also like a version of what we must remember, what black and white people must be reminded of about where we are, what our history is, and what the long record has to tell us.
Well, yes, we do forget, don't we? You know, I think that's part of the problem is we haven't together, I mean, as Americans, always remembered the struggles and the difficulties. There's even a book out, Racism in Florida Within the Klan and Sheriffs and Complicity, and that is part of the background of all of this. There's a long history, as the residents of Sanford, Florida would say, that this plays into. And so there's a few things. One, it's horrible as an incident, and I think if anything can come of being able to talk about it and think about these things, besides bringing the man who shot him to justice, I think, is a way to talk about this history and this context. And so we can maybe better understand each other in order to prevent such things from happening. But I also think we have to be honest about the history and the way that this isn't as isolated or as shocking for black folks as it perhaps should be, even now. The shooting, shockingly, is horrible, but it's not the first time, and I hope it's the last time, but I'm not sure. The horrible thing is that then police sort of said, you know, that's just how it is, or we believe you completely, or whatever was said. And I think that's really almost as troubling. You know, there's sort of two crimes there, in my opinion.
This idea of black culture at the very core of American culture, American experience, is, of course, not new. Duke Ellington wrote very articulately about it in the 30s. Ralph Ellison, of course, the ending of Invisible Man is a, he's saying at the lower vibrations, this is about you out there. Alastair Cook, I was just reminded the other day, said at some point on the BBC that the most important invention in America was the 12-bar blues. And that speaks for the. I was also struck hugely by Isabel Wilkerson's history of the black migration, 50 years from World War I roughly to the Civil Rights Movement. But the idea that 10 million Americans, the people, the athletes, the singers, the writers, the poets, Motown, the NFL, I mean, the NBA, that changed the way this country looks, sounds, talks, and put its huge stamp on it. At what point did it click as a central idea that you had to develop further, the idea that American experience, African-American experience are completely inseparable and almost coterminous?
I think in many ways, the blues is a good way to begin thinking about it. I mean, for me, my family's all from Louisiana, and both my parents grew up in the country. And I just love the feel, look, taste, smell. I mean, it's Louisiana, so you got to love the taste of that place. And I think in many ways that independence in the face of what some people would, you know, see only as segregation or difficulty, the independence that both sides of my family charted, either through the land or through song, however they made that happen, I think really stands behind me. In other words, I inherited my grandparents' ideas, which I don't even think were ideas. They were foodstuffs and quilts and ways of talking. And so those kind of pioneering spirits, I would say, were really important to me. And also, just on my father's side, for instance, we've been in that same parish for about 200 years. So the idea that that experience wasn't an integral to the American experience would be really strange to me. In fact, it's sort of, to me, part of the blood and dirt and land. And basically, when I go home there's two cemeteries that tell these stories in different ways, which are old enough that some of the names are disappearing slowly. So, but they're not disappearing from the earth, they're just disappearing from a piece of stone. So for me, that was always part of the experience. The flip side of that is I remember being in my grandmother's in southern Louisiana, my grandparents, I should say, and hearing both my grandparents on the porch talking to an older woman in the yard, and they were speaking, I didn't understand what they were saying, and I realized almost instantaneously that they were speaking French to each other. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, this was some aspect of their lives that I hadn't quite known. And I think in some ways it was both a revelation and a kind of realizing that blackness was very complex and layered, and also maybe contribute to this idea of a kind of secret language that I kind of talk about in this idea of storying through the book. And you know, I ended up in writing the book thinking of it as not just a hidden tradition that I was trying to lay out, but also a tradition of hiding it from the spirituals to the blues and even hip-hop.
I love the way you wrote about Louisiana in this book. A breadth of being, a fullness that is part and parcel of freedom that we farmed and would not sell for anything. It is ourselves we knew as renewable, sustainable, and not just black, but evergreen. The feeling of being both colored and not, being everybody's, being cosmic, a black cosmos. Most of the universe, you write, is made up of dark matter. In what point in white America's life do you think this has dawned? What Al Murray would call the omni-American sensibility.
I guess this tradition of hiding to me starts in slavery, and I trace it from there, which is to say there is a tradition of, you know, these cosmograms that people would make that they've recently uncovered, some in a attic in New York City, which is a very important discovery, and to some people probably wouldn't have looked like much, but luckily the discoverers knew that it referred to a sort of way of organizing the universe. But then there's under Marilyn Hirth, there were these religious items. And I guess I think that that idea of the cosmos, the self as a cosmos, to me predates Whitman. And it is just as important. And just, you know, just as Whitman changed this idea of the I and how expansive it could be, I think black folks were doing that too. And that to me is really important. You also have the spirituals, of course, which are coded for escape, you know, swing low, sweet chariot means tomorrow, get ready, let's go, you know, and the fact that that was misunderstood by the hearers, many of whom who are white, doesn't mean we should make that mistake. And I think as readers now, whatever our origins, it's important for us to kind of take that on and hear it in that double way, I guess. And I think that that has actually happened, just to answer your question in another sense, which is that the enjoyers of blues and jazz, they understand its double entendre, its many meanings, the fluidity of existence that jazz postulates and then I think makes happen and embodies, which is great about jazz. It's not like a theory about fluidity. It is fluidity. You know, it's pleasurable. And I think that that's one of the things I wanted to kind of think about is pleasure. And I talk about that especially in the soul music chapter where I talk about, it's called Moaning. And I wanted to think about the power of pleasure and how important that is, especially in a world that sometimes denies it.
On this matter of, you know, the American experience and black experience, it just reminds me, presuming to argue with Harold Bloom, we both love Emerson, and we were talking one day about who was the 20th century Emerson. And he likes to say, you know, if God had been an American in the 19th century, it would have been Ralph Waldo Emerson. In the 20th century, it would have been Charlie Parker. And I say, no, it would have been Duke Ellington. Either way, the group leader or that blazing soloist, it comes out an African-American. So I'm wondering, is that close to the thread of the whole argument?
I think it's a wonderful argument you're putting forth. I think I might vote for Duke Ellington as well. I also think back to the 19th century, and I talk a lot about, you know, Sojourner Truth, for instance, or Frederick Douglass, whose voices I think are so fascinating. Sojourner Truth's question, "Ain't I a woman?" is so, you know, much of today's question in a weird way. And, you know, the question I end up circulating is it better to be unread or misread? Is it better to be not ignored, invisible, to use Ralph Ellison's metaphor, or to be misread completely, opaque, you know, left misunderstood? And I mean, that's even at stake in something like the Trayvon Martin case. To be noticed is to die in this moment. And I think that's a profound thing that stretches all the way back. But I, like I said, I don't want to only define it as struggle, though sometimes it is struggle, but triumph as well. And thinking about it in terms of pleasure, which Duke Ellington, of course, knew.
Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure. Now life is awful again, a trough full.
And I love, for instance, the Billy Strayhorn biography, Lush Life. I think that's a tremendous book about the individual who is part of this group. And I love that they, you know, both had an understanding and sort of just had a handshake, you know, they, for all these years. And it really brings up a lot of questions. But I think Strayhorn paves a kind of way, and Lush Life especially having written it so young as he did, is such an important text. And it's one I talk about a little bit when I talk about this idea of elsewhere, a place that is suggested by the spirituals that is not here, that is better and profound. You know, you might call it heaven. But I think even just only call it heaven doesn't understand the way Lush Life, the song, participates in that. You know, I'll live some lush life in some small dive, he says. And that kind of lush life is a kind of elsewhere. It's not heaven, but it is a kind of place that is beyond the self, beyond place even.
There's so many musical touchstones in your head and in this book. Pick a few and riff on them. You name them. Could be Ellington, could be Sam Cooke, could be Aretha, could be hip-hop, could be Jay-Z.
I think I would think first perhaps about Curtis Mayfield, who I think about a lot. I mean, what a great songwriter he is. In the book, I talk about him in the soul music chapter, of course, for many reasons, not least of which because I think he writes these foundational texts like Amen, you know, the song that, you know, I heard every Sunday in church, basically, amen, hey, you know, this kind of, and I just thought it was, you know, a way of singing it. And that's actually a song he wrote, which I just think is amazing. He takes one word and turns it into a song. And that kind of almost wordless quality is something I talk a lot about in the book. But I also wanted to talk in soul music, for instance, about its transformative qualities, the ways it wasn't just something purely black, but a way of making something black. So Curtis Mayfield has an amazing record, Curtis Live, which everyone should get. In it, he does a cover of We've Only Just Begun by the Carpenters. And before the song, he says, you know, this next song is what some might not call underground, but I think underground is whatever, I think he says, whatever you say, as long as it's the truth.
We've only just begun to live. White lace and pride. A kiss for luck, and we're on our way.
And his transforming of that, suddenly he's singing We've Only Just Begun, and it suddenly is a song about us, about African Americans, about America, and about this idea of beginning and starting. It's revolutionary in that way. And I think I tried to sort of talk about how love sometimes is, or always is. And that kind of profound idea, I think, even in this little performance, which just always haunted me, is back of what I was thinking. And then, of course, a music like hip-hop is sampling soul quite a bit, right? It's thinking about older musics. And I really wanted to understand in what became the hip-hop chapter this idea. And I ended up thinking a lot about lostness. As I say in that chapter, hip-hop is in love with lostness. It's always looking for a haystack and a needle. And in this way, I think, you know, the needle's often literal. It's literally often a record that it is manipulating along the needle in order to get at history and nostalgia and not do it once, but do it again. How do you do that? Hip-hop seems to be asking. And the artists I admire do that very well and take on soul as part of its foundation and part of its understanding.
You write that what hip-hop is longing for is longing itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a way in which the nostalgia in hip-hop isn't just for, like, the past that was better, which I think is fairly familiar, but it's more for, like, an idea of the past thinking about the future. So you have a band like Wu-Tang Clan, you know, they're obsessed with Voltron and all these old cartoons and Japanese animation and kung fu movies, many of which project a future of jetpacks and kind of superheroes. And so they're thinking about this childhood that had its own future. And I love that because I think that's also part of our times. We're often doing that. We're often wishing for, you know, where I was supposed to have a jetpack by now, where is it? You know, that's kind of almost the feeling that I think hip hop provides and that I think people are drawn to in the broader culture and why so many people find hip hop moving.
In another bag entirely, James Brown is a huge figure through your book and obviously your head. Tell us that story.
Well, James Brown, I mean, you know, his music's pumped into your blood, you know, and he changed so much the fabric of music, and he had so many phases from, you know, sort of soul crooner to funketeer. And, you know, I think it's embodied in that great line from The Big Payback where he says, "I don't know karate, but I know crazy." And I was thinking about that a lot when I was writing the book. I mean, it's almost the epigraph for the whole book in some weird way, but he the wordplay, of course, but also this other kind of jujitsu he's, I think, performing on music. So he really undergirds to me both the modern or postmodern, in some sense, African-American experience, but then also an experience I talk about in the book called post-soul and thinking about what is soul music after soul music, you know? What happens after, say, for me, 1968, when I think things changed both with King's being killed and the Kennedys and, you know, the 60s sort of end there in many ways. So I was trying to understand that in that part of the book, and that's how Jimi Hendrix comes in. All these people seem to me so linked to soul, but then have different experiences after it. And then, of course, James Brown, you can't have hip-hop without the funky drummer beat that was sampled so widely in hip-hop.
One, two, three, four, get it!
Well, you know, just the other day I played the whole song again because it's just a rake in the whole song. You know, it's probably 12 seconds or something like that in a like 9-minute song. And I think that's what it is in part. I think that those breaks are more than just these beats that, you know, DJs found they could extend and thereby just provide kind of the heart of the song. But I think in many ways that's it too. It's also the heartbeat of the song literally just played out.
I wanted to ask you about Billie Holiday, and suddenly it dawns on me, I have to ask you about Whitney Houston, too, who died since this book went to press. But talk about stories that have the mythic all over them. Where does that story fit in this huge saga?
Well, Billie Holiday is so crucial, and I was trying to talk about her as not just a tragic figure, who I think often she gets read as, and we forget her voice. Or rather, her voice conjures these other sad stories.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Yet at the same time, I wanted to think about Strange Fruit and the way she sang that song with no applause, you know, and this powerful story of lynching, which wasn't written by her. It was, in fact, written by a white person, you know. But I think that, again, thinking about transformation and the way it became her signature song. And I also started thinking about the refugee and all sorts of aspects of culture that aren't necessarily worth going down. You should just read the book about it. But I do love the way in which she always said that she wanted her voice to sound like an instrument. And I think that's really a powerful thing that she did. She changed singing, just as Louis Armstrong had done. And I think that what's more is then I think you see now all these singers who are both influenced by her in some ways. And then I argue that, you know, they're sort of modeling their voice on hers. I've also arguing in the book that the instruments now that they're modeling themselves are have changed. They're not jazz music or jazz instruments. They're like computer altered sounds. You know, they often sound quite artificial. And this is not a critique. This is just trying to describe how, you know, why does, I don't know, Rihanna or Lauryn Hill, why do they sound this particular way? And to me, it's looping Billie Holiday's voice through the kind of technological changes that people did to James Brown's drum beat or his hollers. That said, I also think in terms of Whitney Houston, her signature song was so different, right? It was so, and even her voice, it didn't try to sound like an instrument. It almost was too good of an instrument, and she kind of almost blew it out or something. I'm not sure. You know, I wish she was around to still sing some songs, because there's nothing like, to me, like late excellence. The way that a really good singer can hold on to that little bit even toward the end, and just with less notes, but the right notes, make it happen. A quick story that perhaps explains this better is that with my father, I was in Paris, and we ended up trying to find out something to do, and we tried to go one place, it was closed, and this place. Then we asked someone, he said, well, Lionel Hampton's playing across the street. And so we go across the street, and we get like the last two or three tickets to go see Lionel Hampton. We go in there, and they, you know, the lights are down, they start playing. And as you know, he integrated Benny Goodman's band, he, you know, pioneered the vibraphone, all these things that he had done. And here he is, 90 some years old, and he can just pick out some notes. And man, they were the best notes. They were the right notes. And I, you know, just wish that Whitney was here so we could hear her long into the future singing the right notes.
And the self-destruction, I mean, how does that stand in the big history?
Well, I do try to talk about in the Charlie Parker chapter, which is also the chapter that Billie Holiday comes in, this idea of pain and resisting pain. There's the tradition of that, of endurance, that Ellison talks actually quite lovely about in African-American culture. And so that was something I was trying to get at in that part of the book. But it's definitely there. I mean, you know, it's definitely something one has to think about. I don't know how far I got in it, but I also think Miles Davis, who's kind of the third figure in there, is one example of it. Quite literally, his voice being destroyed after surgery and apparently yelling. And that kind of destroying his voice seems to me so in with Holiday's voice. Your question about Whitney Houston's literal voice, Charlie Parker's metaphoric voice, all these things seem to me ways of thinking about the tradition as well.
Dwight Garner commented in the New York Times, this is a wonderful book to sample, to go backward and forward in, to pick things out. Can I just ask you about that marvelous item? I never heard it about Jack Johnson not being on the Titanic. Are we all supposed to know that?
Not necessarily. I know it, in fact, from a poem by Cornelius Eady, which is called Jack Johnson Does the Eagle Rock, which is Jack Johnson picking up the paper and dancing the Eagle Rock, a popular dance at the time, because he wasn't on the ship that went down, because, of course, blacks weren't allowed on the ship. The Titanic's such a central part in African-American culture and blues. There's a number of blues songs about it, spiritual songs, about this idea of the unsinkable ship sinking, whether it's justice for hubris or this idea of, you know, punishment for segregation. I mean, there's a lot of kind of thinking about the Titanic. And there's also a figure named Shine, who is supposed to have been on a porter on the Titanic, who then survives and swims for it. And he's a subject of many body songs and what they call toasts. And I talk about it a bit in the Langston Hughes chapter, because Langston Hughes, who I remember reading this and just being blown away by it, he has an account in the Big Sea of throwing away all his books. And this is his writerly moment, is he takes all these books that have been loading down and he just dumps them into the sea. And I started thinking about that a lot, like, what a crazy central thing for your autobiography or your writing life, presumably, to begin with. And so trying to understand that, I started thinking about the Titanic and loss and, you know, again, this kind of fruitful loss in the case of Hughes against this larger cultural and also loss of life that was just terrible in the Titanic. But, you know, there's some really interesting people writing about this idea of the Titanic and its Irish origins and its black connections and all these things. So I think there's a lot working with that black Atlantic triangle that the Titanic was supposed to circulate.
Speaking of things people like me never heard of, you make an interesting argumentative connection between T.S. Eliot's Wasteland and Bessie Smith's Crazy Blues.
Mamie Smith, yeah.
Bessie Smith sang it eventually, but I guess it was the Mamie version. Make the link.
I just was amazed at the ways in which Crazy Blues and the blues in general kind of named this era. I started thinking of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, which is in a way a metaphor for the time, right? You know, it's the world is a wasteland after the war. And we know now that there was as much personal at stake and not just sort of public and societal at stake in Eliot's poem. But at the same time, I started thinking about how we could also talk about the times that's having the crazy blues. And whether it's Bessie's or Mamie's, I was really amazed at how that record, Mamie's first, you know, started this whole wave of race records and really was distributed. I mean, the numbers that that record sold were just amazing. And how it sort of talked about a circulating of culture beyond the expected and in the margins. The Wasteland, of course, has a number of samples itself of other texts, including Black Songs and Under the Bamboo Tree by Rosamund Johnson. And the ways in which blackness was found in the Wasteland really interested me. Not to mention the ways that many African-American and Caribbean writers talk about Eliot and the Wasteland as an instructional text in a way that they started thinking about their own language. And I almost want to say the sort of samples of culture, you know, the places of culture that they belonged in. And Ellison specifically says that that's how, you know, many black readers, he says, understood that when they read The Wasteland, that he was referring to blackness in many ways.
So the argument is that modernism is somehow rooted in African-American culture, or that's one of its main sources. Just what do you mean?
Yes, many people have written on this idea of the African, say, origins of Picasso's paintings, you know. And I started thinking about it in terms of the blues and, you know, broader aspects of culture. You know, it's a long argument in the book, or rather an involved one. But I think you can see it in many different aspects, even from naming this era the Jazz Age. I started thinking, what if we took that literally? What if we started really thinking about what it meant to be the Jazz Age, not as a kind of wild and crazy time, but, you know, what if going wild about Harry was also about the ways in which African-American culture was sort of an outlet often for white modernists, some high modernists, some low modernists, and some just tourists looking for a good time in Harlem. So there's a kind of interchange that I think other people have written about, but I really wanted to write about it as a foundation of modernism itself and an embodiment of it in the blues.
Kevin Young, as a Harvard undergraduate on WHRB, you were a rap DJ in the golden age of that American art. What sticks? What will stick for the canon?
Well, I wasn't a rap DJ. That's I was a radio DJ in the sort of old-fashioned platter-spinning sense, which is to say that I didn't, you know, mix records or anything. I want to ever claim that skill because I think that's a real lost art. At the same time, you know, it was this really interesting time to be playing new Public Enemy records. And our radio show, as I talk about, was called ARB, which stood for Alternative R&B. So you could play, you know, a Chuck Brown go-go record and then play, you know, I would play Funky Drummer, and then I'd play Public Enemy that sampled Funky Drummer, and then I would, you know, play De La Soul, Millie Pulled a Pistol on Santa about, you know.
Yo, Millie, what's the problem? Lately you've been bugging. On your dookie earring, someone must be tugging. You were a dancer who could always be found clubbing. Now you're worried now with the frown you're lugging.
This really interesting social song about a girl who's been abused and who then by this Santa figure and then goes and pulls a pistol on him. You know, I mean, these are kind of wild. It was kind of the wild west of hip hop, it felt like, which is to say anything was possible. People would sample anything. They would make a song about almost anything about you leaving a answering machine message on their phone. And they were also dead in the whole record. You know, they're supposed to have died, not quite literally, but De La Soul's over, you know. And that kind of resurrectionary idea seemed to me really vibrant then. And I think hip-hop was much more diverse and wild as a result in some ways. Also, it was before a lot of the lawsuits, and so sampling was a little wilder, too. So you would see people not just sample, say, one hook, but they would layer, you know, 20 different things to get a sonic kind of, not quite a wall of sound, it was more like a wall of noise. And I think that was really interesting, and it's a shame that, to me, that isn't as prevalent now.
What will stick to the ribs the way Langston Hughes does, or Ralph Ellison, or Duke Ellington?
I think De La Soul's first record, without a doubt. I think it's such an important record. It invented the idea of skits, or popularized it, you know, on records. I dated a little earlier, Run DMC's King of Rock, and their first record, self-titled. They were sort of concept albums, you know. They were the first hip-hop concert albums, and I think that was a really important leap in hip-hop, which just had been often singles or party songs, people think of it as, though I think many of those were quite interesting. So that kind of leap ahead was really important, I think. I think those, for me, stick to the ribs.
The good stuff never dies. I love the line. Another wonderful quote in the book is from Thomas Sayers Ellis, a writer I don't know, but he was talking about soul and post-soul moment. He said, somebody said the other day that so-and-so is a post-language writer, like they stopped writing or something. Like all the deconstructionists, after deconstruction, they wrote memoirs. I think it's time to talk about me now. All the black people are talking about post-soul. He writes, I don't want post-anything. I don't want to be post-anything.
Funny enough, Sayers and I were both in a Boston-based black collective called the Darkroom Collective. So we were right here in Boston. It started as a reading series after James Baldwin died. Sayers and Sharon Strange and Janice Lowe all founded The Darkroom, and they had this reading series that started bringing people out of the woodwork and also brought established writers and emerging writers and paired them together. And it was a really, I think, transformative thing for Boston. You know, when I joined, which was a few years later, for me, just because it was kind of like, what's the opposite of finishing school? It was like energizing school, you know? It's like so many of those writers have gone on and done amazing things, from Natasha Trethewey, who I talk about in the book, who won a Pulitzer Prize, to Carl Phillips, who was in the collective and just now judging the Yale Younger Poets Prize. You know, there's a lot of writers who some people don't even think about and some do, who are affiliated with it. So I think it had this interesting history. Quite specifically in the book, I talk about the collective in terms of Bob Kaufman, who's a black beat poet from New Orleans many people don't know about, but I think so tremendous and important. Some people say he even invented the term beat. He certainly embodied it, and in that he was one of our kind of avatars. He wrote a book called Golden Sardine, and the title supposedly comes from just a slip of paper found in his place that just said Golden Sardine on it in his handwriting. And so I have a t-shirt that says the Darkroom Collective, and above it has this little golden sardine. Every time I flew, I used to wear that shirt because, you know, it was like a totem. And so was Kaufman, you know, because he was such a powerful poet. I think I talk about in my essay on him, he was such a poet, he never wrote anything down, and reportedly was mostly an oral poet. And he was such a poet that he took a vow of silence from the Kennedy's assassination, JFK's assassination, to the end of the Vietnam War. And that kind of silence and speech seems to me so important to what I call music and silence and noise, and thinking about African-American culture as distillations of those three things.
Would you read a sample of Bob Kaufman, who I had to say I recognize as a complete stranger?
Well, a summer in college, I had a small, tiny bit of money to study Bob Kaufman. And so I moved to San Francisco and crashed on people's couches and moved around a bit and, you know, mostly sort of breathe his air. So I have a little bit where I talk about it. That summer, I enjoyed living in a traditionally, though not necessarily traditional, black neighborhood. No matter how different Lower Haight had grown, this is a neighborhood that used to be called the Fillmore. In feeling, if not in fact, it seemed not so different from the Mattapan my aunt and uncle had lived in since the 1960s, and that was a refuge from Ivy Towers come holidays or whenever I needed one. That was the summer of MC Breed and DFC's Ain't No Future and Yo Frontin', a forgotten hip-hop classic whose Middle Eastern sample proved a rather regular, if welcome, alarm clock ringing from passing cars. If I had to name the summer I lived, it was that roving neighborhood, Bohemia. This, I suppose, I shared, albeit superficially, with Kaufman, and later with Jean-Michel Basquiat, whom I began to write about soon after. But I didn't think of it that way then. I was simply living the life I hoped might lead me to a life of writing. It was enough to share the same air Kaufman had once breathed. Black Bohemia, like black surrealism, is a topic that deserves more and more better written about it. Race, I suppose, is what some think isn't discussed in Bohemia, though that was exactly not my experience. One reason Black Bohemia is rarely discussed, or discussed well, as it is, say, in How I Became Hetty Jones by Hetty Jones, is that it gets into questions that have more traditionally been addressed by the black expatriate. Perhaps expatriate life is where thinking about Black Bohemia begins, with literary exiles like Baldwin, Richard Wright, and Du Bois, not to mention jazz musicians from Ada Bricktop Smith to Dexter Gordon. Bohemia may be the solution for a younger self, expatriatism for the older. Bohemia is often what is being rejected by black folks as they progress toward self-imposed exile, whether moving uptown as Baraka did, or abroad to Paris and then literally Timbuktu like Ted Jones.
Kevin Young, there's a big gap in this book, it strikes me, in the age of Barack Obama, and it's Barack Hussein Obama himself. I mean, so much introspection, patting on the back, some complaints about blackness in that context, persistence of the color line. Again, all this post-racial, post-black stuff. What's your take on the president of FLO, as we called him, around inauguration time? I mean, he's a man deeply versed in hip-hop, enthusiastically committed to the tradition in a way. But I'm wondering, where does the man and his presidency even stand in the cultural history you're talking about?
Well, you know, I've been writing this book for a number of years, so it actually is funny because I had known who he was, actually, because when I was putting together a book called Giant Steps, The New Generation of African-American Writers, my friend and one of the people who ended up in the book, Elizabeth Alexander, said to me, there's this great book by this really smart guy called Dreams for My Father. His name is Barack Obama. You should get it. So I dutifully got it and still have it. But I didn't put him in the book, foolishly, which is perhaps why the book is out of print now. But I have a first edition because I wisely listened to one part of her but didn't go whole hog as I should have. I think he's such a huge presence that I'm not sure that I could wrestle with him fully at the stage I was in the book. At the same time, I was almost tempted to say, well, you know, is this post-Soul era that I've been talking about, which I think is distinct from post-black, which a term I don't really like, and certainly not post-racial, which I don't know anyone who likes that term. Is that the end of something, you know, the start of something else? Could we date from 1968 to 2008 as post-soul in some way? So it did occur to me, but I was also thinking of this as a kind of living thing. So, you know, it's hard to kind of start dating and anyway. So I sort of, you know, I make mention of him a little bit, because, you know, we have sort of shared Kansas roots, and that his mother's from there, and I grew up there in part. I make mention of that, him in that context with Langston Hughes as well. And I guess I think his kind of pragmatic skepticism, as I sort of mentioned in terms of Kansas and Kansans, kind of resonated for me, and I tried to sort of make a link with that. But you're right, there's a whole nother book there, isn't there?
Or a big hole in this one. I'm just thinking, there was a moment around inauguration time when it was easy to think of him as the embodiment of a sort of hip-hop triumph. I mean, out of a black vernacular, a universal statement and range. Adam Bradley, who writes about poetics of hip-hop, said to us at the time, what we've seen, what we're able to witness in Obama's memoir, Dreams from My Father, in particular, is a child of mixed racial origins and a lot of mixed connections with the black and African sides of his origin. Nonetheless, finding his way, stumbling his way toward a sense of wholeness. And maybe, just maybe, he can help this country do the same thing. it seems like a long time ago that we were thinking that.
I guess that's my worry, is it's a bit like when you're writing about film or writing about even hip hop. There's a way in which you want to pick the things, as you're saying, that are evergreen, that are going to last. And I was really trying to do that in the hip hop chapter, is think about not just who's popular right now, but a band like Outkast, who I think sound just as good now as they did then, and you only wish there was more of them. I guess that's the same thing about Obama, is you just hope there's more, and that we can be talking about it in a few more years in a different way, even from sort of the promise. I mean, he also won the Nobel Peace Prize, and it's just a shame that he couldn't even sort of celebrate that, because somehow we had gotten to the point where we're so divisive that that's somehow seen as like not the amazing thing that it is, you know. Right. You know, there'll be other books to think about that as well.
It's interesting to me because I expect he could do an inventory of his own aesthetic, his own consciousness, his own favorite music from 12 years old on till yesterday, and it would be not wildly different from yours, maybe not that different from mine, but it would be hugely interesting and revealing. I did remember one moment in the White House when he was handing out Medals of Freedom, all sorts of distinguished people getting them, but there was one moment when he called on Sonny Rollins, and I just had a feeling the way he looked at Sonny Rollins, he knew all about Sonny Rollins, and if he was going to talk about one person to his kids over the dinner table that night, it would be, I shook Sonny Rollins' hand today, and I'm not going to wash it for a month. So, I mean, I think he's an appreciator of exactly what you're toting up here, but I'm wondering, what is his cultural mark going to be?
The fact that he had, and is only the third person to have, a poet at the dais, you know, to me is just so important. Bill Clinton had Maya Angelou, and then Miller Williams, who's less known, sadly, though a very good poet from Arkansas. And then my friend Elizabeth Alexander. And
JFK had Robert Frost.
So that's four and three presidents. There was James Dickey. I love this footnote. You know, I love footnotes because there's a few in the book. James Dickey read a poem for Carter, but not at the inauguration, not at the dais, at an inauguration ball. Really, we've only had a handful of poets. But to me, what it says so much is the power of the word and the centrality of the word. And I think that's one aspect of the legacy, and I only hope there's more.
Quick digression. Jeanette Winterson was saying the other night, too bad about books, but it was only a couple hundred years in the lives of the masses that mass literacy was considered important, and that she was saying, I mean, here's a celebrated, important English writer of novels and big, serious books, but she was saying it's not the first or the best measure of cultural vitality, and we'll find other ways. I wonder from an African-American perspective, what is the death of printing and of books going to mean? Does it keep you up at night?
Yeah, I actually would have a different view than her. I respectfully disagree. I don't think books are necessarily dying. I think that people have been saying books are dying for a while. And in fact, I have a whole sort of little mini manifesto at the end of my book called Deadism, in which I sort of think about, well, okay, people have been saying poetry's dead for so long. Let's just kill it. Let's do it. Let's, you know, write a dead poetry. Let's see what happens if you make, you know, a zombie poetry. What would that be like? For me, the way is not, you know, to sort of give over to it, but to like perhaps go through. And I think that as a curator, I really think about this a lot. I think there's a kind of misperception about, say, the web, that all the books are there. And this is not true. You know, especially because I'm the curator of a thing called the Raymond Donosky Poetry Library, which is 75,000 volumes of rare and modern poetry that this collector, Raymond Donosky, assembled over 30 years. He was trying to get every book in English of the 20th century worldwide in poetry, every edition of every book. And he largely succeeded. And thinking of, you know, this idea of holes or lost things, there's so many things there that I know of aren't other places, much less online. A, and B, that there's so many things that I still am trying to, you know, the very few, but there's still keeps me going to find things that he couldn't quite find and that we still would like. And I guess I think of it as more of a living library, a living word that we're trying to kind of keep adding to. And in as much as electronic books or things like that add to it, I think that's great. I also think we too often think of newness as exclusively good. You know, we lose things all the time because we're very quick to say, oh, well, we don't need that anymore. I mean, I don't know how many people I know who got rid of all their albums assuming that the CDs were available, and they're not. I, in fact, had a long conversation with a guy. I think we were on a plane or something, and he was just despondent about the records he had gotten rid of that he just assumed were there and that they're not, you know, and forget the fidelity questions or the quality questions. And I think we're almost in a similar place with books, which is I'm very much used to reading books. I think they're still beautiful things. And I myself think of books when I'm writing. I mean, I write books. I was telling a friend, I write books, not, you know, downloadable files. So it's very hard for me, you know, the visual, the tactile, the scale of the thing gets so reduced by the digital book that I think you're going to see a lot of people in a number of years. And I see this among the young people I teach or show material to. They're really taken with the book. And I think you're going to see a kind of return to the book in a really different way, but also, I think, a deeper way. I think, in other words, we've been taking it a little for granted, and even this idea of the death of it was strange to me. I also don't understand why authors are trumpeting this more than anyone else. You know, I sometimes see book people, the first people in line to kill the thing off. And I think it's almost because we're used to not getting our way or something. You know, it's kind of a self-fulfilling or self-abnegation, you know. So it's sort of a funny circle there. I really believe in that in such a strong way that I'd have to take a little bit of exception to that comment.
Last question for me, Kevin Young. The argument of the book is that the African-American experience is so deeply rooted in all American experience, and maybe vice versa. But beyond that, how is it that African-American is now an almost open and universal identity that can include Rihanna, born in Barbados, or Nicki Minaj from Trinidad, or Zadie Smith, born in London, or even Barack Obama, raised by white folks in Hawaii? Is cosmopolitan not sort of built into the African-American identity by now?
Oh, I think in many ways it always was. I mean, many of the people we talk about as African-American heroes in the, you know, or, you know, black heroes, Du Bois, Douglas, these people were biracial. So I think that both by circumstance, law, and other reasons, history has been true that blackness has always embodied a wide array of, should we call, entry points, you know? And it's something I thought about a lot, especially when I was doing an anthology of younger black writers. Some were Caribbean American, some were, you know, born here, raised there, you know, and I think that's actually to the richness of the thing. You have some of that in, say, T.S. Eliot. You know, he gets claimed by the Brits and by Missourians, yeah, St. Louis. You know, and that's sort of the connection, I think. The St. Louis blues sort of flows through Eliot, and it flows all the way down the Mississippi into the jazz of New Orleans and is coming out of Louis Armstrong's horn. So I think of that kind of river and ocean and the Gulf and the Caribbean and the what gets called the Black Atlantic as really part of this conversation. And, you know, I talk about blackness. I don't just talk about African-Americanness, which the two aren't exactly interchangeable, though they are, of course, related. I was really interested in that diversity and unity we were talking about. And I think that's important. It was ever thus, you know, there were always, you know, Harlem is in the Harlem Renaissance, which of course didn't just take place in Harlem, but in DC and Paris and all over the world, always had Caribbean writers, always had, you know, gay writer, you know, it had a breadth of experience that I think is really important. And I guess I see as a kind of given, you know. And I love this idea that you mentioned, the cosmopolitanism, because I think it's so important. I was also interested in this idea of the cosmos and the black cosmos. And that was really one of the ways I wanted to express that.
Kevin Young, it's such a pleasure. But I would be negligent if I didn't ask you to read a poem of your own. Sure. While we have you. Take us out, as they would say.
And this is Flash Flood Blues. I'm the African-American sheep of the family. I got my master's degree in slavery. Immigrant to the American dream, evacuee. I seen the water ladder its way above me. Swam to the savings and loan. No one home. I've steered hardship so long. Even my wages of sin been garnished. Wolf tickets, half off. Collect call and response. Whenever we pass on the street, death pretends not to know me, though the grapevines say, he's my daddy.
Kevin Young, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. Real pleasure.